glimmer, some suggestion that you'd have me if I could only make me better, then I would stand a little stronger as I walk a little taller all the time. Because I know you are a cynic, but I think I can convince you that, 'cause broken people can get better if they really want to, or at least that's what I have to tell myself if I am hoping to.
And one day this will all be over and we'll all be in recovery happily ever after. Correct, Francis and Aaron?
That's right.
Correct.
This is life will be perfect.
Perfect. This is Giuseppe Ganci calling. Calling? No, I'm not calling. This is Giuseppe coming to you from the downtown east side of Vancouver. We're in Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and you're listening to Talk Recovery Radio. I've got Francis Stone and Darren Gaylor, my co-host here. Hello, Darren. Hi, Francis.
Hello, hello.
Hi, Giuseppe. Welcome back.
Welcome back. Yes, yeah. I've been away for like 3 weeks, and I'm going back. No, I'm really lucky, enjoying the gifts of recovery. Just did an amazing trip to Thailand with some great friends, and I'm like super relaxed.
Yes. You're a different shade.
A different shade, yes, yes. Well, I'm glowing too, I hope. Thailand was amazing. Usually we start the show off with hot topics, but I really haven't been following the media the last little while, so I have no idea what's going on in British Columbia. Usually I've got a pretty strong opinion about what's happening, but I needed a break after a crazy summer and a crazy year, so it feels pretty good.
Well, you did have a little opinion about the wall thing there, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, but that was a tourism thing. Yeah.
We discussed that. If you would have listened to the show, you would have known that.
Oh, really? I know I'm getting in trouble here because I didn't hear the show while I was away. I'm sorry, okay?
Get it online, you know.
It's online, yes. You can follow us on Twitter. You can follow us on Facebook. Our podcast is on iTunes, and our Facebook Live is just going through the roof with our personal stories. We've got Courtney in studio that's going to come on a little later on and tell us her personal story. One thing, though, that I just wanted to point out, you know, I'm really lucky. We're lucky because you're all part of the same community I come from. You know, New West Recovery has, you know, 4 or 5 meetings a day, you know, from the 20-person meeting to like 300 people a night, and that's 7 days a week. And you kind of, you know, bitch and complain about, you know, meetings and recovery and all that. And it's funny because guess what, everybody? We've got something to complain about. Like in Thailand, it's totally different. You know, we tried to go to some meetings and, you kind of get shot in Thailand if you do drugs, you know. It's totally different, you know. And I remember when we found this one home group, they have buildings for home groups, and we're talking about 12-step fellowships here for those that are wondering. And it's interesting, like they've got a sign on the door, but it was part of a complex of apartments, I guess you can say. Everybody was just like, you know, not knowing what goes on there type of thing. Like, it wasn't,
it's
like,
real underground.
Yeah, it's super underground. The only meeting I was successfully able to go to was a white person. It was like an English meeting. Everybody was white. Nobody was from Thailand. And I was like, wow, this is really weird. Yeah.
That's kind of odd, just because I think that's what I experienced when I first came into recovery, was that there was just as much shame in addiction as there was in recovery. Like, I was embarrassed about both. So,
both, yeah. Yeah. Weird. We talk a lot about that on the show. It's like, yeah, there's a big stigma about addiction, but there's a huge stigma about recovery. Once I get clean and sober, I don't tell anybody. It's interesting. And, you know, I walked all over Bangkok for hours, and I never saw anyone do drugs. I never saw, you know, like, I didn't even see any homeless people, to be honest with you. Like, I saw a couple of people with severe mental health issues, that I don't think anything would get them in a stable housing. But for just like regular people homeless on the streets, I didn't see any. Not one. So that was, and I was looking. So that's,
I don't know. That kind of scares me. That makes me think like everybody is like holed up somewhere so that they don't.
Could be. I don't know.
Seen.
I don't know what the, I don't know. I mean, the thing though, I was there with people from Thailand. Like it wasn't just me showing up. Like I hung out, like my roommates from Thailand. We hung out with all her friends. We went on a road trip for a week across northern Thailand, and they gave me the dibs. Like they don't let anyone fall in Thailand. Like they're so strong culturally, and it's like not okay if your brother's just like hanging out on the street. Like the whole family will gather together to make sure
tribal
don't fall to the point where there's, you know, that point of no return. Like just, you know,
that makes more sense.
Yeah, it's so normal to shoot heroin every day on the sidewalk that that's what he does. That's what Johnny does. Like there, it's just like, that's not what Johnny does, right? Anyway, we're way past our opening. Usually we spend the first 5 minutes. So you listen to Talk Recovery. You follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Talk Recovery Radio. And thanks for listening, everybody. And we're going to move over to Frances now. She's got a great guest, and we're talking to someone that has a great book out there that I want to read. I haven't had a chance to read yet. Frances, who's on the show Talking Recovery with us?
So today we get to talk recovery with Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the University of California, Los Angeles, otherwise known as UCLA. And she is also the author of Addiction Recovery Skills Workbook, Dr. Suzette Glasner, PhD. Welcome to Talk Recovery, Suzette.
Thank you.
Thank you. Would you prefer that I call you Suzette or Dr. Glasner?
Either one is fine.
Okay, I just know my teachers when they say, like, you know what, when you earn a PhD and you earn doctor before your name, I hope people call you doctor. So,
so okay, you might as well use it then.
Okay. Dr. Glasner, so tell me, is this book designed to be read by the doctor or the patient?
Well, it's interesting you ask that. I actually, I wrote it to be read, by both, but initially I wrote it to have something out there that was for the patient, because I feel like we talk a lot in circles of addiction science about all the things that are most helpful to our patients, but then I didn't really see that there was a resource that would explain some of these science-based therapy techniques in a way that someone should just pick it up and try and use the exercises if they were struggling with an addiction. So I wrote it to the patient, but I've also found that it's really helpful to work through the exercises and the workbook together with a therapist if you have access to one. So yeah, those are the two ways that it can be used.
Right, and so I don't know about in the United States, although I've heard rumors, but I'm not sure, so I won't believe those. But I know in Canada there isn't really any information or education given to doctors around addiction specifically. Like, I think of all those years that doctors go to school, and yet there's not, I think, one specific course that teaches them about addiction. Outside of that, the DSM-5, like, they would have knowledge around mental health and that sort of thing, but not, addiction isn't recognized within the DSM-5. So I just wonder, do you think that this is a place where doctors are starting to get more information, where they're starting to learn about how to direct their patients towards help?
I do think that there's a movement in that direction. And, you know, one of the areas of research that I've been involved in is in some methods for screening people for substance use issues when they're in primary physical health care settings, rather than, you know, waiting until they get somewhere where they're in need of help for a severe addiction. And so there's been kind of a big rollout in emergency rooms and in primary care settings, and all, even in psychiatric care settings in the United States, of some of these screening methods where you just ask a few screening questions about a person's recent alcohol or drug use, and then if they appear from that screening to be at risk, then you do sort of like a brief motivational kind of conversation with them to see if they'd be willing to do something about it. And then if so, you refer them to appropriate care. And I can't say that that's used everywhere, but there's an increasing awareness of that, of these kind of brief types of interventions that you can do. And naturally, that has led to more training and awareness of the generalist or the general healthcare professional. But there's still a lot of work to be done in that arena, I think.
Yeah, I would agree. I do think that the overdose crisis is very motivating towards that work being done, which is, I guess, one positive thing about it. But the subtitle of your book is called Changing Addictive Behaviors Using CBT Mindfulness and Motivational Interviewing Techniques, which to a layperson, they're not going to know what that is. Do you think you could give us a brief kind of description of what those three things are?
For sure. So I'll start just with CBT. So CBT stands for Cognitive Behavioral Therapy, and that is, well, if you break it down into its components, you've got the cognitive piece has to do with the things that go through our heads, our thoughts, so that make us vulnerable to relapse or continuing to use alcohol or drugs in destructive ways. And so those thoughts can be ways that we justify it or minimize it in our minds, or sometimes things we tell ourselves, like, you know, I can't control this, or I'll never get better. I mean, there's a whole range of ways of thinking that can interfere with recovery. And then those are usually linked to emotions and behaviors. So if you tell yourself you're never going to succeed or you're never going to stay sober, of course, that would lead to an emotion like feeling discouraged or hopeless. And then that would be connected up with some kind of behavior, like either you continue to drink or use, or maybe you don't totally comply with your treatment, or maybe you isolate or do other kinds of behaviors that make it harder to recover. So in CBT, we look at the links between the way you think, the way you feel, and the way you act, and we try to figure out where are you starting thinking at times in ways that aren't totally rational, and then being able to recognize those things and how they trigger relapse or how they interfere with recovery, and sort of correcting them or thinking of alternative ways to cope, both in terms of alternative ways of thinking and alternative ways of acting, or, you know, doing things differently in your life.
Dr. Glasner, do you think that that is sort of the basis of a 12-step program? Is, like, I've thought that often, like, even, I mean, if you break down praying, it's really thought stopping, you know, like, it's sort of like shifting your brain to think about different things, to act different ways so that you have a different result in your life. Do you feel like a basis of, you know, what was, you know, developed in 1935, was that cognitive behavioral therapy to a certain degree?
Well, I believe that there is a lot of overlap between what we call cognitive behavioral therapy and the methods that are taught in the 12-step program. We just call them different things. Not to say that there aren't some very unique features to each of them. There certainly are. But like you said, you know, praying can be a way of thought stopping. And like seeking social support like you do in the context of 12-step meetings, like that's a coping skill that we teach in CBT. And not letting yourself get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, those are all identifying triggers, right? And we do that in CBT. So I think that the two of them actually, like, really are very compatible with one another. They're just presented somewhat differently in terms of the terminology that we use and the particular philosophies that guide the 12-step program are a little bit more specific, whereas in CBT you're trying to break down the components more of thoughts, emotions, and actions, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. And in terms of motivational interviewing techniques, is that something that you would use when somebody is just trying to, maybe they're still using or they're still engaging in addictive behaviors, but trying to get them to the other side of even of making some steps towards recovery? Or is that something that you would use when the person is already in recovery? How would that work?
So I would use that at all stages of recovery. Intuitively, of course, you would immediately think, like, you need to motivate somebody. Well, that means that you need to motivate them to change, and maybe they haven't changed yet. And that's certainly a way in which motivational interviewing is used when people have mixed feelings or ambivalence about coming into treatment. It has been very widely used as a way, as sort of an interviewing and a therapeutic technique for helping people kind of really examine the pros and cons of the way they're living their life and sort of getting the person to see for themselves that some kind of change is really necessary to get them to their life goals and things like that. And that tends to be a really, really useful way of getting people into treatment when they're sort of mixed and on whether or not they want to do anything about their alcohol or drug use. But then you also find that because the guiding principle of motivational interviewing is that you're trying to help people resolve ambivalence or mixed feelings, there is ambivalence at every stage of recovery. So even when somebody has already become clean and sober for a period of time, there's always some ambivalence about whether they want to stay in treatment, whether they want to stay clean and sober from everything or just their drug of choice, whether or not they want to continue in therapy, whether or not they want to live this way for the long term. Like, those kinds of mixed feelings or questions come up throughout the recovery process, so it can really be utilized at any point.
And you have a few steps on your 7 steps, actually, on your website that are very helpful, and I looked over them. And in terms of mindfulness, you have step 5, become mindful, tune into, not out of, your experience when you crave drugs or alcohol so that you may make mindful choices about how to handle them. That, to me, sounds very optimistic. I guess I'm wondering, when you write these steps and have these steps, is this for somebody that is a little bit cognitive already in terms of being mindful? Like, I know for myself, I don't think that I entered into mindfulness maybe until like a couple years into recovery, because I had so much like crying to do and things like that. Like, I don't know, just everything was just so raw. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Is that normal for most people, or are people more apt to be in step 5? I'm just thinking of, like, even right now in Vancouver, I don't know if you've heard of the Downtown East Side, but that's where we are, and that's where we do the show from, and it's very entrenched in barriers and poverty and addiction here. And, like, I saw somebody overdosed on the street on my way into the station with the police and ambulance, thank God, around them, trying to revive them. But that is where we are bringing the show from. So when I read things like from that, I'm thinking these are like around here in the Downtown East Side is not necessarily the client that you're trying to help with mindfulness. Do you know what I mean? Because they have so many, it's survival here.
Right. Well, you know, the skill of mindfulness can be practiced in different ways. And part of the reason I throw mindfulness into the mix is that I really have the strong belief from my experience in working, you know, in treatment and recovery for many years, is that the same tool may be totally helpful for one person and totally unhelpful for another person. So my thought was, equip people with as many different types of techniques that they can practice and draw upon, and then see what works for them. So I wouldn't say for sure, you know, that mindfulness is good in early recovery versus late recovery. It's really different from one person to another. But the idea behind it is that you can feel uncomfortable emotions, like you did a lot of crying in the beginning of recovery for quite a while. You can experience the tears and the profound sadness, and you can just accept that it's there without having to do something to terminate it, you know? So most of us, like, it's a very intuitive kind of thing that we do. When we feel something unpleasant, we try to get away from it. Like, we either run away from it somehow, or we, you know, avoid it somehow, or we do something that'll make us forget about it, or thought stopping, you know, those types of things. But sometimes, it's more effective to just accept it as it is, allow it to be there, and recognize that it doesn't have to pull you in a particular direction. It doesn't have to pull you to do something self-destructive or to use or to isolate or to deprive yourself of good things in your life. it can just be there as part of your process of your journey of recovery. And that's sort of the mindfulness mindset. You can embrace that in varying degrees, like over the course of your life. You can become, you know, very good at meditation as part of your way of doing that. You know, you can practice it just in everyday life. You can practice it just when you're feeling down. But I guess my point is that for some people, this might be very useful, and for some people, it might feel impossible, and that's okay, because you just try it, and if it doesn't work and you're doing better with behavioral CBT concepts, you just use those.
I hear you. And can you tell me, what is a self-expert?
Okay, so that that is a little phrase that I coined when I was writing this book, but I'd actually been using it in therapy practice for a while. It was my best way of describing how you get really a good handle on your most unhealthy behaviors that you want to change, not just addiction, but in this context, and use it in the context of understanding addiction, is that you become the expert on yourself and how your addiction takes over you, how it works, when it's the worst, when you're most susceptible to relapsing, when you feel the most vulnerable. And the way you become a self-expert is, I mean, part of this is a mindfulness concept. You just start paying really close attention to all the circumstances, both personally in terms of your emotions, your thoughts, and then also like environmentally or contextually, like where you are or with what friends or which family members when you're feeling triggered. And once you have like a very thorough understanding of when your addiction is like has the most power over you and under what circumstances, then you can start to anticipate those situations or those emotions as making you vulnerable, and you can start to plan ahead of time how are you going to handle those different scenarios or those different people who trigger you or those different emotions. So you can be sort of prepared for it.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think that I know that I've experienced that in my own recovery. Like, I know that 1 year I decided, because I would always be triggered by my family at Christmas, no offense, family, but, you know, they were the people that I've grown up using alcohol with, so it's totally normal to drink with them. And so that's a part of just knowing that that's a part of what we do at Christmas. So it was something that I had to be conscious of once I did want to actually succeed at staying sober through Christmas, because there is a part of my recovery where I didn't necessarily want to succeed. You know, like I was like, oh, that's a really great excuse and they won't hold me accountable. And so, yeah. But when I did actually want to succeed was when I decided to have Christmas dinner myself and host a non-drinking event. So that's like one of those things, I think, that once you do want to succeed, you are going to think about how you can succeed.
Yes, I would completely agree with that.
So tell me, in terms of... where am I? What do you think is the most effective treatment for addiction recovery between CBT, mindfulness, or motivational interviewing techniques?
Oh my gosh, that's a tough one, because so CBT is probably the most well studied of the three. It definitely is, and that has like very reliable, from study to study, from different substance to different substance, like very reliable, consistent positive effects. So I would say there's the strongest evidence basis for that one, but that doesn't mean that it's better than the other two. The other two also have a slightly different focus. So with motivational interviewing, it's really about helping a person to sustain their motivation to engage and participate in the treatment process at all stages of recovery. And so by itself, it doesn't really give you the skills you need in recovery the way that, you know, 12-step or CBT or mindfulness might, but it would just keep you engaged. So it's like very important, but I wouldn't say that it's better. It would probably be best used in combination with the other two techniques. And then mindfulness, in my own research on mindfulness, because it's so useful for regulating emotions, it seems to be really helpful for people who struggle in particular with anxiety and depression. So I would say mindfulness is high on the list as well, and I don't think there's enough literature out yet scientifically to say that it's better or not as good as CBT. The studies so far comparing it to CBT have shown that it does just as well as CBT, so it's like an equally good alternative, but it might be especially useful in people who are struggling with their emotions. So that's just something to keep in mind when you're sort of figuring out what your go-to strategies might be, what your particular struggle is. Is it staying motivated? Is it general recovery skills? Then CBT. If it's motivation, it's the motivational one. And if it's emotions and managing them, it might be mindfulness.
Yeah, I love that. And I must thank you, Dr. Glasner. You are really a wealth of information. So thank you for doing the work and having all this knowledge. I did read a couple reviews of your book on your website, and of course you're only going to put the good ones on there, but still I thought they were quite informative. And one of the reviews said that the book gives key tools to build the motivation to change. So I'm wondering, how do you do that? How does somebody open this book and get motivated to change?
Well, you know, there is a chapter that I devoted to motivation and exercises that can strengthen your motivation. And if you're willing to take an honest look at the way in which your behavior is, in the addiction sense, is impacting your life, then those exercises can be really powerful because they kind of help you to see, to generate kind of like concern about what could happen if things were to stay just exactly as they are, and maybe a little bit of incentive about what you really want out of your life and in your future, that could provide an incentive for you to change. And also just sort of like taking an honest look at what kinds of things have happened as a result of your use so far. Some things that may be positive, like, you know, some people, you know, obviously when people start using, there's some positive impact, otherwise no one would do it, right? So, you know, taking a look at some of those things that you're still seeking from using, but also looking at how that balances out with the negative. And usually for someone who's picking up this book, there's enough negative that they're looking with open curiosity at the possibility that they need skills for addiction recovery, so they're probably fine that the negative outweighs, you know, the positive or the positive that they're seeking. So through all of those exercises collectively, the idea is that a person, you know, builds and strengthens their motivation to do something about it. But it's not, it shouldn't really all be negative. A lot of it should be based on the wonderful things that you can get out of life once you're brave enough to make the change. But it does take a lot of courage.
Right. I was actually just thinking about that. On this show, anything that's part of a solution that brings somebody from, you know, contemplative, that gets them forcing themselves into some change is great, right? So what is it that people, like, once they go to a doctor and they get, you know, so they seek withdrawal, whether it's medications or not, and then most people sort of think, well, I haven't used in a while, like, I'm okay. You know, how do you get somebody into seeking therapy or getting them into that? No, you got to keep going. Take this book, like that courage you just mentioned. Like, what's the timing there? You know, because if that individual isn't going to be the one walking into a bookstore to pick up a book, you know, to face themselves, so to speak. Like, yeah. What do you suggest? You know, families, do they hand over a book? Because the families don't know either, you know?
Yeah.
Like, what do you say? What kind of intervention needs to take place at that point?
Well, I think that from the outset in treatment, one of the things that might be helpful to educate people about is the fact that with the research studies on addiction treatment and outcomes from addiction treatment and how it works, what they show very clearly is that the longer people stay engaged in some form of treatment, the better they do in the long term.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that means is even when you feel like more or less like everything's okay, staying engaged in some kind of therapeutic context that serves as a constant reminder of how important your sobriety and your recovery are and how to maintain it, and sort of it's almost like getting like a little booster or a little checkup periodically. Like, even if you feel like you're stable and you're okay, the reminders are always have the potential to be therapeutic and very useful to maintain that.
Right.
And that can take many different forms. It can be a book if you, like, want to do self-study, you know, with the Addiction Recovery Skills Workbook. Sure, that could be helpful. It could just be continuing to go to meetings. I mean, the literature on meetings shows that the more actively a person is involved in working a program of recovery, so actively involved in, you know, commitments at meetings or, you know, sponsoring others, that kind of thing, the better, the more helpful the 12-step program is in their recovery.
Right.
So maybe encouraging, like, more active involvement over the long term, or, you know, just continued psychotherapy, maybe not every week, but maybe, you know, once every couple months or something, like
right.
a check-in,
so
that kind of thing.
Empower yourself and sort of, you know, cut the ties somewhat of, you know, all of those resources that sort of begun the process of change for you, but at some point you got to sort of, you know, phase out of those.
Right.
So you just mentioned, you know, a lot of principles of the 12 steps, and you know, there's a mentality in the 12 steps. There's a lot of loyalty there. You know, I don't do 8 steps. I don't do 4 steps. I do 12 steps. But you sort of just mentioned how, you know, you can incorporate the two, your book, it, within 12 steps. And most people are going to look at a 7 steps book and think, oh, this is for people who don't believe in the 12 steps, let's say. I mean, you know, so what is it, like, how well can your book incorporate into it? And when would somebody, you know, through that, what are they getting tired of doing the 12 steps, or they just want to try something different? What would you suggest there?
Oh, okay. So, like, at what point would they pick up this book, or would this book correspond with the 12-step program?
Yeah, both.
Yeah, you know, the reason I didn't title the book 7 Steps to Addiction Recovery is because I didn't want the implication to be that this is, like, something separate and distinct and a different kind of, you know, approach that may be at odds with 12 steps. So, you know, for me, breaking it down into steps was just a way of helping organize how and what sequence you would attempt all of these different types of therapy techniques that I offer, and how would you come at that in sort of a structured way.
Right.
But it's entirely compatible with the 12-step program, and it's not at all, like, as opposed to 12-step. I know that, you know, people, from my experience, you know, treating people with addiction, I have worked with some people who feel like 12-step is just not a match for them. So I don't insist that 12-step meetings must be part of one's recovery, but I have seen the transformative impact of 12-step for a lot of people. So I really strongly encourage those whom I work with to seek out the support of a 12-step program. But if not, you know, I don't know to what extent in your neck of the woods these are available, but we do have some alternatives to 12-step type of groups. Like, we have Rational Recovery, and we have Smart Recovery. Yes. So, you know, that we have dual Recovery Anonymous for people who also struggle with dual diagnosis of other mental health issues. So I try to encourage thinking outside the box if people are not super receptive to 12-step. But in general, I feel like some type of social support network, and, you know, the one that obviously is the most prevalent and available is 12-step for recovery, is really important, integral piece of it. So I don't think anything that I would that they would learn through CBT, mindfulness, or motivational interviewing would really conflict with 12-step. I think it could only be enhanced.
Well, I'm definitely looking for a little bit of that brevity thing when it's coming to working the steps, so definitely want to check that out. I'd rather do 7 than 12 for my next go-through of self-care. So we should mention the book is The Addiction Recovery Skills Workbook, and we've been talking with Dr. Glasner. Dr. Glasner, thank you so much for taking your time today and speaking with us on Talk Recovery.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Okay. So you can check out our Facebook page, Talk Recovery, and check out where you can get the book. We'll have a link for that. and also Dr. Suzette Glasner's website and all that. So it's time for our first break, and we'll be back with Courtney on our personal story part of the show. And let's get into our first song. This is a little Bob Marley, Three Little Birds, to make your rainy day a little bit more sunny.
Everybody,
what's up?
We're live, Darren. Okay, and we're back live on Talk Recovery Radio, and we just finished talking to Dr. Suzette Glasner about her seven-step approach to recovery. That was a great interview, Francis. Yeah,
thank
what
you.
An awesome topic, and what an awesome conversation.
She was very knowledgeable.
Very knowledgeable. Need to put these on so I can hear myself. There we go. Oh, that sounds so much better. I can hear myself now. So this brings us to the personal story time, which we started a little while ago, bringing people's personal story of overcoming addiction to the airways. And today we've got Courtney. Hi, Courtney.
Hi.
Welcome to Talk Recovery Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having you. And we've got a special guest in the studio today. And Darren, who's in the studio with us today?
This is O-Town right here.
Yeah, say hi to the camera. You're famous now. So, Courtney, we brought you to the show to tell us about your personal story. So,
absolutely.
I always love asking the first question. How did you end up in a black chair here at Talk Recovery Radio? Wow. So, give us a bit of a brief look at how you got here.
Wow. Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, just even driving down here today, I mean, this is where my journey started. Again, I was a chronic relapser for the last 10 years, and I used a lot of the services in the downtown east side. I had been in and out of the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous and doing, you know, step 1, 2, 3. And then when it was the time to take a look at myself, I would leave again. And I couldn't do it anymore. Right. I had lost my family completely, and I had lost myself. I had overdosed multiple times, in and out of really horrible relationships, and I was on the bathroom floor one day, and I was like, I can't do this anymore, right? And checked myself into detox again, and called my mom, because that's the only place that I would call her from is detox. I've been there numerous times, and she was happy to know I was still alive, and this time I had been willing to not put a time frame on my treatment stay or anything, and I moved to New Westminster. I moved out of the city of Vancouver and fully surrendered.
So you were in your days down here in the downtown east side, mm-hmm. and you ended up going to detox, and you ended up doing some harm reduction services down here. So tell us what it was like. Like, how hard was it for you to get out of the downtown east side, and what was it like to, you know, not stay down here?
It was, I think, more, it was the battle within, like, myself, right? Like, there was a lot of opportunities for me to get well, but I fought with that. I wanted to control it. I wanted to, I wanted to be able to get well on my own without anyone around. Like, it was a battle with myself, really.
So you say, like, I wanted to do this on my own. That's probably one of the biggest problems down here is, like, yeah. I can do this. I think a lot of it, would you say a lot of it has to do with basically blaming everything on everybody? So how could everybody help me if it's all their fault?
Yeah, I think that's a lot of it. And a lot of it being just, like, fear. Like, fear of being vulnerable with other people. Fear of getting vulnerable, you know?
We were talking in the car on the way down here, and mm-hmm. you had spent some time at the Union Gospel Mission.
Yeah.
And I was like, what was that like? Because for some reason, your first reaction to knowing about the services in the downtown east side is like, everything must be bad down here.
Mm-hmm.
But you were like, oh, I loved it, you know, and it helped you get to where you're at today. And what was that experience like?
Yeah, I had a lot of the same fears as well going in there. I'm like, oh, it's going to be dirty, you know, it's going to be whatever it's going to be, people are going to be using. But it looked like a spa, to be honest. You know, it looked like a spa. It was a beautiful place. And I wasn't, you know, physically well yet, but I started to just really be able to, like, care for myself again and have that little vision of hope, you know?
A lot of people say that there's not enough services for addictions here in BC, and we need more, we need more, mm-hmm. we need more. I mean, do you find that to be the case?
From what I think, we do have a lot of harm reduction available. It'd be nice to have, like, I think, a larger detox facility, you know?
How long did it take you to get into detox?
It took me about a week.
Okay.
Okay, but I've had to wait before up to 3 weeks.
And if you mind me asking, was it drugs, alcohol, opiates?
Opiates, drugs, and alcohol.
Drugs and alcohol, yeah. Kind of everything.
Everything,
right? Yeah,
right? Yeah. I was dependent on opiates, but I just didn't want to feel, right?
And you went to treatment?
I did.
Okay.
I did.
And how long was your treatment stay?
I took my time. I was there for about 7 months.
Okay, and there was...
I went to Westminster House in New Westminster.
Are you still on opiate replacement therapy?
No, I'm not.
What do you think of that conversation? There's a big conversation out there that if mm-hmm. you don't stay on opiate replacement therapy, you're going to die.
Right, right.
So are you going to die?
No.
I'm just wondering, because I go to a lot of conferences.
Absolutely.
Like,
yeah.
A lot of conferences, probably 20, 30 a year, and mm-hmm. I hear these people with really long credentials, PhDs, the evidence shows, you know, that you need to be on medication-assisted therapy for the rest of your life.
Right.
What do you think about that? Like, if I told you right now, you know what, you need to go on medication-assisted therapy.
No, I mean, I've done both of the replacement therapies. It didn't keep me clean. You know, I had gone out, I had gotten caries at one point, and I would use them just to not be sick, right? So I kind of did use them as a crutch. I think for me, like, yeah, I would know we need the connection. Mm. You need the connection with other addicts.
So what's the difference that you can point out that lets you carry on and be abstinent and not have to keep on with that crutch to someone that may still... And there's obviously nothing wrong with medication-assisted therapy. I just think it's wrong to say if you don't take it, you're going to die.
Yeah, no, I agree.
You know, I think that's the problem we're going to end up in if we keep saying that to people. Marginalized people are already being told, hey, you need to take this, you're going to die. Well, I know tons of people like you that have gone past this. So what do you think is... What's the difference between you?
I think it just really comes down to, like, willingness, right? And seeing the process working for other people and just going through the physical withdrawals with support, you know, with lots of support and, you know, the fellowship and then also just having, like, Talk Recovery. You know, for me, like, I listened to Talk Recovery when
you
I was
did?
Loaded.
Yeah, really? When I was loaded. Loaded? Wow.
Like, it was, yeah, it was a part of my journey. Like, there was some kind of hope there, and there was some kind of desire.
Sometimes right? I'm like, nobody's watching, no one's listening.
I don't even know how I found out about it, too.
Oh, you
but
knew?
But it just, I don't know.
Oh, that's pretty
that's
cool.
Crazy.
And, like, now 180, eh? And now
and
you're
now
on
I'm
the
here.
Microphone. Nice, nice.
So, and I never, you know, you hear it all the time, but I never thought this was possible.
Yeah, I guess the whole thing is, I mean, when you're out there and you're using and all that kind of stuff, even if you, like, get introduced to recovery and relapse, and you never really get a full understanding of what life can be like, you know, until you actually stay clean for a little while and participate in life. Because you, I mean, really, like, I was kind of, like, at that place where it's just, like, you really didn't know what full responsibility would be like.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it's actually pretty cool.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, like, I think for the longest time, like, I overcomplicated it. I was, like, oh, I don't want to get clean again. I have so much to leave behind. You know, I have, like, my boyfriend. I have my dog, right? And it's, like, when I just said, like, okay, yes, I'll try this, like, stuff got better, right?
Volunteer radio. 1 minute you're the camera operator. The next minute you're...
Pretty soon you'll be making me coffee.
Right? Okay. Okay. Hey, Courtney. So, so I want to ask, you did. I think it's so amazing that you watched the show and that now you're on the show. Mm. I love that, like, so much because we've been doing this for 5 years. So have you... Were you watching it, like, say, like, when it first came on, like, 4 or 5 years ago?
It must have been about 3 years ago. 3 years ago. And I was listening to it on the radio.
That's so awesome. Yeah. I just love that. Because, yeah, especially in the early days, like, we didn't know. We just keep showing up. Yeah. We just keep doing service, really, because, yeah, that's a big part of the show. But, yeah, so you've also become a mom in recovery.
Yes, yes.
And we know each other personally, full disclosure. Mm-hmm. Me and Courtney are friends. We both go to the same Mother's Recovery Tribe meeting, and Mother's Recovery Tribe, if people don't know, is a nonprofit for mothers in recovery from addiction.
Yeah.
It's just a support group. So when did you become a mom?
I became a mom on March 30th of 2018.
That's awesome.
Yes.
And so what was that like for you? Because, okay, I will tell you a little bit of my story is that I got pregnant trying to, like, sort of fix my life. And so it was a very big surprise.
Right.
And so it was just something that I really had to work through and just come to a place of, like, being true to myself. Like, it was a big deal to like have a child, to make that commitment, right? So you would have been about a year sober.
Yeah.
And so what did that look like for you?
I had some fear around it, but it just felt right. Right? Like, I have God in my life, and, like, something just felt right. Like, it was a surprise. It wasn't planned. And I just knew that I would have a lot of help and support no matter what, you know, and it's been a blessing.
And you have, so now it's Calvin.
Calvin,
right?
Yes.
Yeah, and he's so sweet.
He's
and
gorgeous.
Such a smiley little guy, like, so cute. Like, seriously, the kid never stops smiling.
That's why I say he's a blessing. Like, he's absolutely, like, perfect. Nice, you know, nice. And it's, yeah.
And you're his mother, so yeah. Of course you should feel that way. And then, so you are co-parenting now with his father, who is also in recovery.
Yes.
And what are some of the challenges of co-parenting, and what are some of the blessings of co-parenting?
I mean, obviously, we're both so in love with our son, right? So we want what's best for him. Overall, like, we're getting along great. Like, the program really helps us with that, with, like, open communication and love for our son. And we're a family now, right? Like, it's not perfect. Like, there's ups and downs. But overall, like, it's working for us.
Do you think that it's, like, helpful to have a partner or a co-parent that is also in the sort of, like, I would imagine, like, being almost, like, it would be similar to being of the same faith, but like of the same program, where it's like you both have a similar desire to act in a certain way in terms of being personally responsible for your own part within the situation.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. It makes it a lot easier because we can apply, like I say, like the steps to our conversation or anything. And it's also like what I was going to touch on is, I don't even consider myself like a single mom, you know? I have lots of help from him, and if I need a break, he's there.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think co-parenting is becoming more of the norm instead
100%.
Yeah, instead of just thinking outside the box a little bit with parenting and it being the mother's sole responsibility to do everything.
Exactly.
Yeah. So being a part of that. And so has it deepened your recovery, becoming a mom?
Yeah. I think it has, you know, so. I mean, I would be clean no matter what, and I'd be working, you know, my program no matter what, but being a mom, it's just like I have that purpose now to stay clean, even more so than ever. And I incorporate him, like I take him to meetings when I can, you know, not all the time, because that is kind of like my time, and, you know, he's my son, not an addict, hopefully, or, you know, if he is, you know, the options are there, but... And even going to Mothers in Recovery, you know, like I'm able to connect with more women and be kind of like a role model to them.
I would agree. I definitely would agree that you are. What is Darren doing there?
I don't know.
Okay. Oliver is making an appearance here. Oliver would like to say hello. Oh my gosh.
So cute.
Okay, seriously, though. Seriously, though, this is ridiculous. That is like, wow. Okay.
That's awesome.
Okay, way too distracting. Okay, so Courtney, and so I know with me, my children definitely deepened my recovery, but also, you know, they deepen it in the way that I need God so much more.
Right, right.
Because it's such a daily grind. Like, children Absolutely. Are wonderful, and they're beautiful, and they're little miracles from heaven that, you know, cry and poop and scream and make constant messes. I mean, that's just the reality,
Absolutely.
Right? So has your relationship with your higher power changed?
I think I talk to God more. Absolutely. I feel like such, of course, a close bond with my son, and I kind of feel God working in me more, you know, but I think it's like remained the same a lot as well.
Nice. It sounds like you're like in such a good spot in terms of being in a supportive community.
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
I know when I was a single mom, like I first a single mom, I didn't have anyone around me. And that's really when drinking became a problem in my life. So I think it's amazing that you're in recovery, that you have the support of your co-parent, your community. Like,
yeah, it's been huge.
Yeah, that's
amazing. It would definitely be a struggle if I didn't have the support around me. Absolutely.
Yeah, and even talking, like just being able to talk about what's going on. So
yeah, it's huge.
So there could be a woman somewhere, just as we're ending our time together, but there could be a woman that, you know, has been listening, that's still using, that could have been in your situation, you know, now you're here. What would you like to say to your former self if she was listening?
I would say just do it. Like reach out your hand and follow the guidance of other people.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
Just do it.
That's awesome. Just do it. Just get out there. Let's take,
because it's hard, right? Like, we overcomplicate it, and we don't want to leave what's comfortable. you know, and it's that constant battle, but you just have to do it.
Yeah.
It's so simple, but so hard, you know, at the same time.
Yeah. Just even make one little move towards just recovery. Just
absolutely.
One small step.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for being on Talk Recovery.
Thank
it's
you so much.
Awesome to have you.
Thank you.
Check out Mother's Recovery Tribe. I'm going to put a little plug in there. Mother's Recovery Tribe is on Facebook and Instagram, and be a part of our Mothers in Recovery community. And yeah, thanks for watching Talk Recovery.
And thank we got you. Darren in the back there. Hi, Darren.
Oliver.
Oliver's back there as well. So yeah, we got a baby in the studio. Thanks for listening, Courtney.
Thank you.
Thanks for being on the show today. Really appreciate your honesty. And I'm glad that you found us on the radio years ago. And hopefully that inspired you just a little bit. And it's awesome that you're on the show today. And don't forget, mark your calendars down. We've got an awesome New Year's Eve party coming up on New Year's Eve. It's going to be at the Anvil Center. There's two price points. There is a dinner and dance ticket, and then there's also a dance only ticket. So yeah, join us on Recovery Day at the Anvil Center. All the information's on Facebook. And Darren, what are we listening to next?
Oh well, thanks for listening, everybody. Talk Recovery. We'll see you next week. We're leaving with Bedouin Sound Clash, Money Worries.
Yeah, yeah. Money, money, money worries. None of mercy.